From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 26th day of August 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois. And in about 26 minutes, we'll talk about the agricultural weather forecast. Pete Levitt is away today. In his stead, Mike Tenora of tstorm.net. All of the agricultural weather at the bottom of this half hour. In agricultural news for the day, a new law in Brazil would restrict foreign ownership of its farmland. A Russian consumer watchdog group is not satisfied with the safety of U.S. poultry. And China's largest fertilizer distributor is not very happy about BHP's bid to buy the world's largest producer of potash. Dave Dickey will have all the details right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
The Closing Market Report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from L&M Commodities, a full-service brokerage company serving area farmers with professional market advice and crop insurance products. L&M Commodities has offices in New Market, Indiana, Leland, Illinois, and Terrell, Arkansas.
In Chicago on this Thursday afternoon, futures settled like this. September contract in the soft red winter wheat for the day had a settlement price at $6.56.5, up 8.75. December at $6.88.5, 8 cents higher, and the March wheat at $7.11.75, 12.25 higher. July of next year at $6.97.25, up 9.75. Hard red at $6.91 in Chicago, up 14.75. Back here in Kansas City, now back in Chicago for the corn pit. September contract of $4.16.5, settlement price up 11.75. December corn $4.32, 12 higher. March at $4.45.5, 11.75 higher. And the May futures at $4.53, up 11.75. July at $4.59.25, 11.5 cents higher. December of next year at $4.40.25, up 8 cents. September soybeans $10.13, up 13 for the day. November $10.14.5, up 15.5. And the January at $10.22.25, up 15.25 for the afternoon. Bean meal September at $3.06.30, up $6.60. Bean oil at $39.49. up 35 on the afternoon. Livestock numbers settled the nearby August live cattle futures at 98.42.5, down 17.5 cents. August feeders at 114.92.5, up 17.5. And the October lean hogs on a Thursday at $75.80 for 100 pounds, down $1.30. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. October crude oil futures, $73.31 a barrel, up 78 cents for the day. And the crude, or the ethanol, at $1.90.06. That's up 5.6 for the day. Natural gas at $3.82.8, down 4.3. Heating oil at $2.07, up 3.7. And the gold futures at $1,235.40 an ounce. The settlement price down $4.10. The Dow now under 10,000 at 99.89, down 71 points. The U.S. dollar at 82.92 is down 0.33. And the CRB index on the afternoon at 64 is 2.2 higher for the day. Here's what the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana looks like this afternoon. It's calling for sunny skies, a high near 79 degrees, north-northeast winds at about 5 miles an hour. And then tonight, skies will remain clear with a low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow, sunny, a high near 82, calm, becoming south winds calm, becoming south-southeast at about 5 miles an hour. And Friday night should be clear, a 55-degree low. Saturday, sunny, a high near 87. Saturday night, clear, a low 62. Sunday, sunny, with a high of near 88 degrees. Sunday night, mostly clear, a low around 65 degrees. The extended forecast says Monday will be sunny with a high of 89. Tuesday, sunny with a high of 88. And Wednesday, mostly sunny there, too. No rain in the forecast at all with a high of 85 degrees. The lows will be in the mid-60s next week. We'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour, and we'll talk with Mike Tenora of tstorm.net.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is the Closing Market Report. It is a Thursday afternoon. Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group from Decatur, Illinois, is on the phone line with us. Good afternoon, Dan.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Good to see you at the Legislative Roundtable in Bloomington last night. I recorded both Governor Quinn's and State Senator candidate Bill Brady's comments. We'll run those during the Farming World last week. I bet you had lots of questions about the markets from all the folks that were in attendance. What they
asked.
Yeah,
there was. There's a lot of interest in the markets, a lot of differing opinions on, you know, what the size of the crop is, a lot of discussion on what maybe other farmer advisory services have been recommending and whatnot. So there was quite a bit of discussion concerning the markets and how they are performing here.
Did they pin you down on the size of the crop for corn?
Well, no. I'm not that smart. I do know that at least the early stuff that we're hearing around is coming in less than last year and less than expected, but we're in the poorer areas, I would sort of speak. We haven't really got into the areas that are supposed to be good because they're a little further down the road. But I think you can tell by the way the market is acting, it is anxious, and the end user is worried that this thing is going to go a little higher on them. That the crop is not as big as what USDA says it is, and I think you kind of saw that kind of come into the marketplace here today.
That's what was at play. So we gained 12 cents in the new crop December for the day, settled at $4.32. What can you see on the charts?
Well, as I've said this several times through the spring and summer months, is that the corn market is as counter seasonal as it gets. We had a counter seasonal decline during the spring months when the market usually goes up, and now we've had a counter seasonal advance when the markets normally go down. And I don't see any change in that overall trend. It's going to take something to come in here and shock the market, if that is going to change anytime soon. And when you're in a counter-seasonal move, you don't fight the trend. You just get out of the way and let it go. And that is what we're seeing here in the corn chart. I think from a technician's point of view now, we're within a nickel or so of striking at the most recent highs of 439 and 437.5, and I would say technicians will be watching to see if there's enough muscle in this market to blow right on through those highs here tomorrow or early next week. And my guess is that there is. I think we're going to blow through them. We're going to go on up, and we're going to check out this January high of 449.75, and we're going to go from there. But it's a counter-seasonal market. It's demand-driven. And now with some early yield reports implying that maybe the crop's a little smaller than what's on the books, it's got everybody anxious, Todd.
They're all anxious. The wheat market and lack of wheat in Russia, I suppose, pushing things up. Turn your attention to, or holding the corn side up, that is, turn your attention to the soybeans, and I'm wondering whether you think that they can manage to move much higher along with the corn and the wheat, or whether the burdensome supply of that crop eventually will take it lower.
Well, let me take a look at the charts. I think today's advance went a long ways in dressing up the technical side of the chart. We are now ahead for the week after making a new low for the decline. We did manage to close again above the corrective low point in between the double top formation here of 10.11.5. And if we maintain today's advance through the close tomorrow, we're going to close out the week with a weekly reversal to the upside. and I think that bodes well for the market to do to go right on up toward that double top up in this 1050 area and blow through it and set the sights on maybe a move on up toward $11. So that is what technicians will be looking at to see if this market's got enough muscle to go on up and see if it can find those buy stops up there at that double top at 1050, 1052, 1053 or not.
At this point, producers will start rolling in the fields not long from now, but still a bit away. If you had to tell them on all those bushels that they need to haul to town and either store or sell, are they going to put corn in storage and sell the beans across the scale? And you want them to store both? What do you want them to do? And they've got to pay at storage for elevator storage.
Well, I don't know if I want them to do anything. I mean, I think they have to make their own decision. I think for those that have a good crop, these are nice prices. These are better prices than probably what anybody thought we were going to be looking at back in June 1. I guess, you know, I'm a technician. I like to follow the trends. And, you know, it's a counter-seasonal move. So my biases anyway, from a technical point of view, a seasonal trader, would be to kind of take time and watch, let the market go ahead and move to the levels that it wants to go. It's demand driven, my guess is that once we get through Labor Day, everybody's going to quickly focus on the next supply demand tables revisions in the world numbers and the September crop report, and I think it'll be pretty hard to knock the market down going into that September report.
All right, now turn your attention, and we just have maybe a minute or two here left. When you look at your long-term charts, where do we stand as you look maybe out into January and then July of next year?
Well, nothing's perfect in this market, but from a cyclical point of view, or at least the cycles that I have watched over the years, made a career out of watching them, would tell me that one needs to be on the outlook for some kind of fall high and a decline into the spring months. Now, how that plays out, you know, we'll have to take kind of 1 week at a time and 1 month at a time. But I guess I would be inclined to take advantage of if we had saw new contract highs going into a time frame that we normally make seasonal lows. If we were making contract highs, I'd be kind of looking at those as good selling opportunities right off the combine. If I wanted to re-own it, I would attach a call to that cash contract. Our elevators offer that as a tool for farmers to sell their cash right off of the combine, put a call onto it, be in position to take advantage of additional price strength if it does materialize as we go on into the winter months, depending upon what happens in South America.
Anything we didn't cover you want to make sure we talk about today?
Well, I think you need to still continue to keep an eye on the outside markets. The dollar has been kind of chopping around. There is kind of a little small head and shoulders bottom formation on the dollar chart that does imply that there could be a spike up in the dollar, and if that would materialize, that could maybe take off the fluff on these corn and soybean rallies as the combines begin to roll. So I do think you need to keep an eye on that dollar and the direction of that dollar, and a lot of that's, you know, is dependent upon what happens, I think, both politically and economically over the next 60 days or so.
I suppose that's one of those fundamental things that could change things and result in a fall high and a decline in the marketplace.
That could very well be. You have to be watchful for a shock. It's kind of something to kind of change, take it out of the zone that is trading in, shift that zone, shift the trend in it. So that's what you have to kind of be watchful for. And I don't necessarily know what that's going to be, but I think we'll know it when it comes the market will tell us.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Very well.
Dan Zwicker is with ADM Grain Group. He's in Decatur, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report each and every Thursday afternoon. You can hear him again if you'd like on our website at willag.org.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
I know you're going to be busy in the field, so if you can't get to us on the website and you can't hear us on a radio station and you want an update of either the opening markets or the closing numbers, call this number, 217-333-3434 at 1015 and 315 daily. Now here's Dave with today's agricultural news.
In agricultural news, Brazil's president has signed a bill that will restrict foreign ownership of the country's bountiful farmland. The bill, which has been in discussion for the past 2 years, will not be retroactive, meaning foreigners who have already purchased land under the old rules have nothing to fear. According to a note published by the Attorney General's office this week, foreign purchases of Brazilian farmland will now be limited to parcels of 600 to 12,300 acres, depending on the region. Parcels larger than this limit will require special permission from the Agrarian Development Ministry. Also, by the new rules, foreigners individually or as a whole cannot own more than 25% of any single municipality. The head of a powerful Russian consumer watchdog group today says that Russia may take action against imports of U.S. poultry unless it receives more assurance that the birds are not contaminated with salmonella. The USA Poultry and Egg Export Council this week assured Russia that U.S. poultry is safe and not affected by the salmonella outbreak that has forced the recall of more than half a billion U.S. table eggs. But officials at the watchdog group were not convinced and say they are assessing the rules. The group was key in January in stopping U.S. poultry trade over issues with the use of chlorine wash rinses. China's largest fertilizer distributor, Sinofert Holdings Limited, is very concerned about BHP's $38.6 billion takeover offer for Potash Corporation and believes the potential deal will have a big impact on the economy. Speculation lingers that Sinofert's parent, Sinochem, may join a rival bid to counter BHP's offer. Sinofert Chief Executive Feng Zhenbin did not immediately comment on speculation that Sinochem may be involved in a bid for potash. Meanwhile, BHP's chief executive is flying to North America this week to speak with Potash Corporation shareholders. China is the world's biggest user of potash, and there are fears BHP would ditch the prevailing annual contract potash pricing system in favor of a market-based approach if its bid is successful, as it has done with iron ore. Ukraine's Customs Service says today that it will keep up quality checks on all Ukrainian wheat export shipments and could extend them to other cereals. Traders have criticized new custom measures on grain shipments out of Ukrainian ports, saying they are significantly slowing exports to a grain-hungry foreign market. Customs has allowed exports of just 220,000 tons of wheat so far in August. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report and of Commodity Week. You can find both of those programs, in fact, all of our agricultural programming from IPM, anytime you'd like on our website. The address is willag.org. It's posted there not long after it airs on our radio stations. And in its full entirety, you can go and listen to all of the program anytime you'd like at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at willag.org. That's W-I-L-L, AG.org. Hey, while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our weekend newsletter as well. Your director of ag programming, Dave Dickey, writes that one, releases it over the weekend. It's all about marketing corn, soybeans, wheat, and livestock. If you're interested, it's free. And if you'd like to unsubscribe once you've gotten on the list, it's just as easy to get off of the list. It all happens over on the right-hand side of the page at willag.org. Just hit subscribe or unsubscribe. If you come back and you're already subscribed and you hit manage your subscription, you can also give us your cell phone number. And on USDA report days, we'll text you the numbers from the United States Department of Agriculture. It's all part of the service from Illinois Public Media Agriculture. Up next, you know, farmers consistently hear about 300 bushel corn. It is the theoretical maximum yield for the plant. During this year's Agronomy Day on the U of I campus, that's last week, right here in Urbana, producers learned it may be possible to reach that with the right combination of management and, as you'll hear, the input or high-tech players. Agronomy Day at Illinois is a big deal. This year, about 800 attended the event on the U of I's Home Research Farm. They rode rack wagons into the fields to hear from the scientists about things like, well, how to manage corn for the maximum yield. Right now, that's 260 bushels to the acre if all of what agronomist Fred Below calls the seven wonders fall in line. Those wonders are weather, nitrogen, hybrid selection, previous crop, plant population, tillage, and chemicals.
So here's how the story goes. You know, if you have all these wonders, if you have each of the seven wonders optimized, you should be able to grow 260 bushels. And guess what? We can routinely grow 260 bushels here. Now, by the same token, if you screw one of them up, you're going to grow less than that.
Well, it's easy to grow less than 260 bushel to the acre corn, but also easy to get that yield, too, claims the U of I agronomist. But what about 300 bushel corn? Well, that's a tougher trick, and one the farmers at Agronomy Day learned requires five high-tech inputs, and two of them are twins, both fertilizers. One of them, as expected, is nitrogen, an extra 100 pounds. The other is phosphorus, 100 pounds to the acre there, too.
Okay, even though the soil test says I don't need a P, I put 100 pounds of P205 as Mosaic's proprietary map called Micro Essentials.
So the five high-tech inputs are phosphorus, nitrogen, better genetics, a triple stack, including the rootworm, a higher plant population, in this case 45,000 to the acre, and the use of a fungicide. Sounds expensive, and it is. It still did not reach 300 bushels to the acre, but it did add an extra 66 bushels of yield over the traditionally grown corn yield of about 208. At $4 a bushel, it should be more than enough to pay for the inputs and make more than an extra $140 an acre. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening, of course, to the Closing Market Report. It is a Thursday afternoon. In just 2 minutes, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. Mike Tenora of tstorm.net will be here. Stay with us.
It's National Cherry Popsicle Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1784, Stephen McCormick was born. An American inventor, he was the first to produce a practical cast iron plow with detachable parts. His cast iron board also had an adjustable wrought iron point mounted beneath, able to decrease the draft while deepening the furrow. Before that, he increased the productivity of a water-powered grist mill by improving the shape of the lower millstone. In 1800, Felix Bouchet was born. a French naturalist, he was one of those who believed that life was created from non-living matter in processes such as fermentation and purification. He was, of course, eventually proved wrong. In 1856, William Henry Perkin received a patent for dyeing silk, cotton, wool, or other materials with a purple or lilac synthetic dye, the first synthetic dye ever produced. In 1900, Hedley Marson was born. An Australian biochemist, he spent three decades with his colleagues researching the role of cobalt and other trace elements in animal and plant nutrition. He discovered that ailing sheep often recovered when given cobalt salt supplements. And in 1950, Ranson Oldstyde, an American inventor, his progressive assembly line in automotive production foreshadowed modern mass production methods. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Thursday afternoon from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. On the phone line with us today in the stead of Pete Levitt is Mike Tenora of T-Storm Weather. Mike, thanks so much for being with us and for filling in. You know, I quoted you yesterday on the show, though I wasn't quite sure that it was you. Because I had a conversation with Daryl Good about the Indiana just being really dry, and that came from you. It was for the month of August. How dry were they?
Well, they've had 1.82 inches of rain for the state so far in August, and as you look forward, there's really no rain in sight for the next week. So if you just stick with that number of 1.82 inches for the state of Indiana, that would end up causing it to have its third driest August since 1895. So that's a pretty substantial group to be tied in with there. And the other years were 1896. That was one of the top two driest. And the number one driest, I believe, was in 1897. So this goes back quite a ways.
Well, that is very dry. They're not going to get any wet weather in the next week. Anything after that for them or for any place across the Midwest?
Well, it looks like the next chance for rain for the Midwest holds until around Tuesday, Wednesday, and that primarily affects Minnesota and Iowa, even into parts of Nebraska and Kansas. The interesting thing there is that that's probably the one area that doesn't want any more rain, especially Iowa. I mean, if you look at Iowa, if they had no rain for the rest of the month, they would still end up around a half of an inch to three-quarters of an inch wetter than usual for August, and that was after their wettest June on record and one of their wetter Julys on record, too. So, interestingly enough, in Iowa, they'll have been pretty close to 1993 rainfall amounts for June, July, August, falling maybe 3 inches short of that. But I tell you what, if that rain event on Tuesday turns into a big deal, but I'll just add on to those totals, so we'll have to watch that one.
What's the top of the mind for the T-Storm website at this point and the kinds of things that you're sending out to the client list?
Well, I mean, the main things we're talking about right now are how warm it's been. If you start in April and go all the way forward for Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa, every one of those months will have been warmer than average. I think the only exception was in May where Indiana was right at average. So very warm growing season, which is unusual, and also has been very wet, which is unusual, mainly from June through August, you know, across the western half. I mean, Illinois and Indiana were also wet in June and July. So those are, that's the main thing we're talking about. The other one we're following are the growing degree units. If you look at Peoria, they reached around 638 growing degree day units on August 25th of last year, so that was yesterday. This year, we did that on July 21st, so we're running 30 to 35 days ahead of usual as far as those growing degree units go. So just some interesting tidbits. Other than that, you know, the drought in Russia, we're kind of waiting for rain to show up in the key winter wheat areas so they can get planting. Some good rains are coming to the far northern areas, but central and south, a bit iffy. So if those rains don't show up next week, that's going to become an even bigger problem for them because they need to be planting right now.
Thanks so much, Mike. We appreciate you helping us out today.
Yeah, thank you. I'll talk to you later.
Mm-hmm. Mike Tenor is with T-Storm Weather. That's forecast for agricultural commodities. You can find him online at tstorm.net. This is the closing market report. Stay with us for the farming world if you can. Otherwise, visit our website at willag.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
This is the farming world from the land grant in Urbana-Champaign, the University of Illinois. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason on the phone line with us today. Matt Hughes and Dean Campbell both are either have been chair or currently chair of the supply committee at the Illinois Soybean Association here in the state and set on that board now. We're going to talk a little bit about research and go through a booklet they've released not long ago called Ideas That Elevate. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us. Matt, let's start with you, and we'll do the same thing with Dean, but we'd like to get to know you just a bit. Tell me about yourself and where you're from.
Yes. Well, thanks for having us today. We really appreciate being on, get a chance to talk about some of our research activities. I farm with my wife around in McLean County area, just south of Bloomington. We raise corn and soybeans over there. I've been on the soybean board going on my fifth year now and served. As you mentioned, I was supply committee chairman for the last couple of years. I've moved up to, I'm now vice chairman of the Soybean Association and kind of taken over some more of the policy activities we do there and kind of turned things over to Dean for the supply side of it here for this coming year.
So, Dean, you're now the chair of the supply committee, and these are the folks that take a look at research. Tell me about yourself.
Okay. I grew up and farmed. The home farm's been in my family for about 150-plus years. Down southwestern Illinois, Randolph County, about 50 miles southeast of St. Louis. And I've also been on the soybean board. I'm in my fifth year also and was just elected to the executive committee, which I was the one chosen to be the supply committee chairman out of the exec committee. We each of us chair one of our standing committees. And so I've been involved with the research area, served on that committee now. This will be my fourth year on the research committee. So Matt and I are both up to speed as board members on the research that we have conducted over the past few years.
Matt, a couple of things. I make note in the booklet that you start out by giving an overview of the research investments and explain what a managed research approach is. That's what you probably call an MRA. Where do the dollars come from, and what is an MRA?
Well, the dollars come from your checkoff. You know, every soybean farmer in the whole United States, if you sell soybeans, you pay a checkoff, which is 0.5% of the value that soybeans gets put into a fund. And the Illinois Soybean Association is responsible for overseeing and administering that checkoff here in the state of Illinois for the Illinois producers. We keep half of that money here at the state level and invested in programs, various programs, including the research we're going to talk about today. We also invested in other areas like market development, new uses, and just basic education. The other half of that goes to our national organization, which is the United Soybean Board, and they invest in national initiatives, and we help them in that level as well. So we try to leverage all of our dollars all the way along, whether it be through USP or government sources or even private sources, to try to add more money to the mix and what we can do with our checkoff dollars there. The MRA itself is kind of unique to Illinois in some respects. It's in Illinois, we deal with four major universities, University of Illinois, of course, Southern Illinois University of Carbondale, Illinois State University in Bloomington, and Western Illinois University over at Macomb. And they all four do research in agriculture areas. And in the past, it's always been a problem because everybody's bringing proposals and they're all trying to do their own little thing. And so one of our initiatives as a board was to initiate this managed research area, which tries to bring all the universities together and make them cooperate and talk to each other. And instead of us bringing all individual proposals from all the universities, we coordinate that activity so we don't have a lot of redundancy and a lot of wasted dollars. So we try to make more efficient use of our research that way and make it more focused on outcomes rather than trying to fight with the political politics that got involved before. So it's been a real positive movement for us over the past few years, and something we're very proud of, and trying to, a lot of other states are looking at to us as a good model to try to follow in that footstep.
Your MRAs target 5 primary areas?
Yeah, they do. The areas that we were targeting in the fiscal year 09 were, 5 areas, that being the soybean diseases and insect pests. Soybean cyst nematode was the second. Then weeds areas, what species are problems for Illinois farmers and how can we control those and what kind of research can we work on in that control. Then the soybean germplasm and breeding, trying to look at how we can improve that breeding situation. And then soy nutrition and food science, where we were projects for obesity in children and juvenile diabetes through a lot of nutritional programs, utilizing soy nutrients. And so now this coming year for fiscal year 11, we've added another one in there for the animal nutrition, and we always realized and we're proud that we try to work with the animal agriculture in our state because we know that is one of our biggest users of our product, whether that be soy meal and or oil.
So those are the research areas for 2009, a preview of what will happen in 2011. And then before we delve into each of those separately or the research that's already been completed, maybe we should talk about the yield challenge for 2010. And Dean, we can stay with you for this, I think. And what that might be, that's something that involves actually the soybean specialist here on campus, Vince Davis. And I've done a couple of stories about this 2010 yield challenge. It's underway right now. What are you hoping to accomplish?
We're hoping to surface some new and innovative ideas that may be utilized out across the state by our fellow soybean producers. And Vince has been very instrumental in putting a database together that we can then look at the data as it comes in. But we're currently working, is my recollection, 40-some teams, as we're calling it, across the state. Each of those teams may have up to 10 producers or FFA chapters or collegiate participants involved with them, and we have those three classes in our quote challenge. And they are competing yield-wise against their companions in the 9 districts, which are the reporting districts across the state, crop reporting districts. We use those because they were all previously set up. But our main goal is to, as I said earlier, pick up those new and innovative things because each participant will have one plot of 4 acres?
A 10-acre plot, and they're going to harvest 2 acres out of each.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So they're basically two plots. One, the way you would normally in your day-to-day farming activities, how you would produce soybeans there. And then on the other plot would be anything new you want to try. As long as it's on the label for the products, we condone it. And, whether that's applying fungicides, extra fertilizer, different herbicide routine, anything that we can look at, and then we want to compare. How did that match up? Did it improve? Okay, what segment of it was the help? That's the kind of things that Vince will be trying to glean from the information as we collect it at the end of the year.
Absolutely. So you'll be using Illinois as one really big, large research plot and looking for best management practices or new and innovative best management practices. And Vince Davis here on campus will be taking care of compiling those. Let's move on to the research that's been completed, Matt. Can you tell me about diseases and insect pests and what you're looking for? And maybe we can start with soybean aphids because that's all about the genes.
Oh, yes, yeah. Oh, yeah, you know, when you talk about diseases and insect pests, it's kind of the way it sounds. You know, we're looking at aphids and Japanese beetle and all the insects that you can think about that attack soybeans and all the diseases. But on the side of aphids, you know, we're actually working in a variety of areas, some very basic, just trying to understand the insect and how it functions and what the DNA of it is. But, of course, from a farmer perspective, we're always focusing on the outcomes and whether that be, you know, trying to understand what kind of resistance we might be up against with our traditional, you know, the only control methods we have right now are insecticides. So we need to understand if what we can do to manage that resistance as we move forward. The most promising work we have coming is we do have some resistant varieties coming out, the RAG1 and RAG2 genes that are being introduced in the market right now. So we'll hopefully get some resistance built into our soybean varieties to deal with the aphids. And we're also looking at seed treatments. And again, this is the other aspect of our research, is trying to validate products that are on the market to make sure that they are effective and doing what they claim to do. So in the case of seed treatments, for example, some of them work and some of them don't. And that's our job, too, to make sure when a farmer tries something that he's not out there by himself and just taking a company's word for it in a lot of cases.
Dean, one of the biggest robbers of yield in the state has been soybean cyst nematode, though it works underground, isn't often seen in the way of something that a farmer might pick up in the leaf or the stem of that bean plant, but it can take 30% to 50% of a crop pretty quickly. What kind of SCN or soybean cyst nematode research have you been doing?
Well, it is a very very small critter, microscopic to be exact, and it is a big robber of our yields in the state, and it's hidden because it works in the soil. But we've been doing a lot of research on the genome of that little critter and trying to figure out how it interacts with other pests, so to speak, whether that be the sudden death syndrome or some of the other, the rhizoctonia, to get pronunciation correct. All these scientific names get very, very confusing to keep up with. But we are seeing interactions, whereas the nematode not only makes an entryway for some of these other pathogens, but may also trying to see what the correlation is once they have both infected a plant or only one infects it. There's considerable research going on there. And we're very well blessed here in the state of Illinois that we have Dr. Jason Bond at SIU and Dr. Terry Niblack at Illinois, two of the renowned nematologists in the country, is working on our soybean problems with the soybean cyst nematode.
That's Dean Campbell. He and Matt Hughes are joining us here on The Farming World, both sit on the Illinois Soybean Association board and have chaired at one time or another council that takes a look at research in the state. More on The Farming World in just 2 minutes with them.
Programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the fundamental differences in marketing livestock will collide in Colorado on Friday as ranchers and feeders air out their never-ending argument before federal officials over the value of cash markets versus marketing agreements with packers. It's an argument now heightened by a controversial proposed USDA livestock marketing rule. The GPSA rule will provide pricing transparency as to why a packer paid a particular price for a particular set of cattle. That could provide more leverage for producers negotiating cash sales. Japan's prime minister today says that relevant ministers will meet on Friday to discuss economic steps, adding that Japan's economy is in a difficult condition, hurt by a recent rise in the yen. Japanese officials are expected to exchange views on the basic direction on economic steps and speed up discussions on the yen. And Deere & Company has quietly dropped out of a coalition of large companies that has supported a cap-and-trade program for reducing carbon dioxide emissions. Deere Company spokesperson Ken Golden says that Deere opted to leave the U.S. Climate Action Partnership in May because the group's legislative strategy, quote, no longer served as a foundation for moving forward with climate change regulation. Two conservative policy groups subjected Deere to public pressure tactics this spring in hopes of turning its employees against their company's membership in the Climate Partnership. And that's a look at today's business news.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
This is the Farming World from the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with Matt Hughes and Dean Campbell. Both are from the Illinois Soybean Association and have been involved in how the research dollars are dispersed and those checkoff dollars, how they're used and the kinds of research that is happening at the four universities here in the state. Let's start and pick up now with the weeds, Matt. Weeds are primary competition, and they do a lot of damage in the field if they're not controlled. What kind of work has been done in the state with the checkoff dollars?
Oh, yeah. We're always looking at new weeds, of course, and things. But, of course, the most relevant topic today would be resistance, and that's what we try to keep an eye on more than anything when we talk weeds, and more specifically glyphosate resistance and multi-herbicide resistance that we're seeing, things like water hemp and the ragweeds and things like that that we're having a harder and harder time dealing with. And so we do a lot of research there trying to understand how the resistance develops, how it's spreading, and then more importantly, how trying to develop some management practices that can help alleviate that, looking at different tank mixes of products, for example, and evaluating those, and looking at ways that we can, you know, help avoid any further resistance down the line or minimize it at least. So.
And then a lot of that is done here on this campus. Of course, Brian Young at SIU in Carbondale does some work with it too, doesn't he?
Oh, yes. In fact, you know, just backing up a little bit, we deal with four major universities throughout the Illinois here at Champaign, Carbondale, Western Illinois University in Macomb, and Illinois State University in Normal. And they all get involved in all these MRAs at some level. Of course, like you mentioned, the bulk of it's getting done at Champaign and Carbondale. And Brian Young is definitely at Carbondale, one of the leading experts in the area of glyphosate-resistant weeds, in my opinion, and does a great job down there.
If I remember correctly, and since I'm here on campus, and I haven't looked this up for a while, but I have done some work with him, I think he has a 0% appointment here at the University of Illinois, too. So we'll take claim to him for a while, at least for some of the research he's done. Let's move on. Soybean germplasm. It's always important to look into the germplasm and try to update the genetics in the bean. What are we looking for, and what kinds of research has been done?
Okay, we've been working quite extensively in this over the years, bringing in new germplasms from China, the origin from Asia, the origin of the soybean originally, and we worked over the years to bring in a number of new cessations or new varieties, you might say, or old varieties that are new to the United States. But along those lines, we're doing we're focusing our research for quote the breeding of beans into the the non-GMO varieties. We try to target the areas that the private industries, seed industries, may not be targeting, and keep our focus on things that are going to help the entire soybean industry in the state of Illinois. One of those areas that we've had success through the breeding programs is to incorporate the RAG1 and RAG2 genes, as we talked about earlier, which give us resistance to the soybean aphid. And another area is the white hybridization, and we've had Ram Singh, but he has developed a wide hybridization of the soybean with a distant relative, and the glycine commentella. That's the genus name, the scientific name. But he's trying and has succeeded to bring in at least one gene that is showing resistance to Asian soybean rust. And some of the, you know, that's only one avenue that's been searched out. But we are trying to do on these breeding initiatives and things, we are also trying to capture the intellectual properties that may be there, the patentable products.
Matt, only about a minute and a half to touch on these very quickly, soy nutrition and then nanotechnology.
Well, soy nutrition, you know, that's when a lot of people think about soybeans of net consumer. That's the first thing they think about. They don't realize we still feed, you know, 70% of the soybeans we grow goes into livestock feeds and such. But a lot of soy meal is used in soy nutrition, and the oil is almost exclusively human health and things like that. So we're looking at trying to make oil more healthy. Make better programs for kids. We got a program called Are You a Healthy Kid, for example, is a great program just trying to help combat childhood obesity. We're trying to work on diabetes and things, fighting that with soybean nutrition and things like that. And a lot of good health things that coming out of soybeans. And then on to nanotechnology, and that's really what gets me more excited than anything at the moment. That's kind of the latest cutting-edge technology out there. And to be quite honest, we struggle with that as a board because we don't even know where to take it because it's so new. But we are starting to look at some things, and we're trying to establish the University of Illinois, for example, as a center for nanotechnology in the nation. And we think there's a lot of potential here that we can do as we look at nanotechnology. In terms of, like, there's things like carbon nanotubes and things that can enhance seedling growth, and we can do a lot of things. And most of these things we're talking about are in the non-GMO world. So nanotechnology is doesn't have a lot of the implications of the we've been through with, like, some of the Roundup technologies and other things we've dealt with in the genetically modified environments. And so they're going to be more favorable, but there's a lot of open sky out here and a lot of new ideas that we can start exploring and start to answer a lot of questions we've never been able to look at before. And I think that's going to be very exciting in the future.
Matt Hughes, thank you so much. Dean Campbell, too. Both are Illinois farmers, sat on the Illinois Soybean Association board, and have chaired at one time or another the Supply Committee. You've been listening to The Farming World. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.